E.T. Phone Home.
I'm just having some brewski beers at my Mojo Dojo Casa house.
Wendy, I'm home.
There's no place like home.
Welcome to the House of Cinema Podcast. I am your host, Joe Aragon. With me today, my wonderful co-host, Sydney Volpe. And in the house today, that's my favorite line from Silent Night. Did you like that one?
I'm going to be so honest. I didn't say anything because right when you were saying that, I adjusted my headphone and I was like, I just messed up the whole recording.
No, I didn't even. I intentionally did not say anything because it's my favorite line of dialogue from John Woo's
wow,
Silent Night.
You're going to dupe the listeners with that one. Wow.
I know everybody's gonna be like, whoa, what happened? The sound cut out. No,
that was some of your best work.
Thank you. Thank you. I planned that for the past hour. I was like, how am I going to introduce this podcast? I'm like, what if I just don't say anything?
Wow.
Well, we're talking about John Woo's Silent Night, but also we're going to talk about the latest Godzilla movie, Godzilla Minus One. Maybe if we have some time, we'll kind of scratch the surface on the latest Todd Haynes movie, May, December, which dropped on Netflix this past Friday. Mm. But we'll really talk about the two big theatrical releases here. Big might be a little bit of an overdramatic word for Silent Night, but it might be the right word for Godzilla Minus One.
I think it's not big enough of an expression for Godzilla.
For Godzilla, correct. So let's take this in order, because I know we're both excited to talk about, well, I'm excited to talk about both movies, but one movie we had a very positive reaction to, and the another movie we had a very not so positive reaction to. Mm-hmm. So let's go in order. Before we start jumping into the movies, disclaimer, I think for both these movies, we will talk spoilers. I think for Godzilla Minus One, it is a movie that I think people should go be watching. And so if you want to avoid spoilers, pause and come back later. But from here on out, we will discuss spoilers. Silent Night, I'm sure you care less about. So, but we will talk spoilers.
Yeah, Silent Night, I guess you could say the end. People wouldn't want to get spoiled, but otherwise the movie kind of goes how you would think.
Exactly. It's a fairly predictable ride. And so, regardless, there'll be spoiler talks in both conversations. Let's start with John Woo's Silent Night for several different reasons. The biggest reason is that I am sitting here. I was gonna say sitting across from, but you're across the states. But I'm sitting here with somebody who is famously a hardcore John Woo fan. Sydney Volpe, you have been a Woo fan for as long as I've known you. And when I think of John Woo, I think of you pretty immediately. Aww. How are you feeling going into Silent Night and preparing for this movie?
It's been hard. It's, you know, I've been going through the stages of grief. This was, man, I think because I love John Woo so much, probably my most disappointing movie of the year.
Oh, man, we're just jumping right into it.
I know. Well, yeah.
That's fine.
It's been interesting, man. Because, well, but you're a Woo fan as well, and you've been watching his films lately, and I think we were both really, really bummed out by this movie. But it has been interesting because I think there are John Woo fans who saw something in this film, and there are a lot of John Woo fans who it's been really a really tough pill to swallow. Like, man, Woo still got it, but the movie, it just wasn't there for me, and I have to kind of accept that. That's always tough.
That is always tough. I like to point out to listeners, Sydney texted me, bruh, after she watched it and then called me and said, I quit. She's going to stop reviewing movies. She's done with the podcast. She needs some time to herself to really process what she had just seen in A Silent
Night. It was right before we had movie night for the Patreon, and I was like ranting to Joe, and he's like, dude, we have movie night. I'm like, all right, we'll talk about it later.
And it's funny because I saw the movie about 2 weeks ish before you did, and I expressed to you my concern with the movie, my disappointment with the movie, and how I was nervous for you to go into it because you do a really good job. If there's one thing I really admire about you, Sydney, this is not supposed to be like admiring Sydney Hour, but I'm going to for this one second.
Oh.
Is that you do a good job.
Back to just shitting on me all the time.
I don't shit on you all the time.
All right, let's hear it.
I think Sydney does a really good job not letting the greater world influence your kind of opinion on a movie. Like, you're not one to get really caught up with the hype too often. I think many people, including myself, can get really swept up in like the overwhelming negative or positive reactions, but you're very true to yourself. If you feel like something wasn't as good as you loved it or you thought, you'll be honest with me and with our listeners. And I think that's why when I knew Silent Night was coming out, I knew I was disappointed. I was so curious to see how you would react. So when you called me to say, I'm taking a break from reviewing movies, I knew at that point we had something interesting on our hands with A Silent Night. And I'm curious if you feel like, how do you feel like general audiences are going to respond to a movie like Silent Night? People who aren't Woo enthusiasts. We're talking just like your everyday Joe Schmo is going off the street and walking into something like Silent Night.
Okay. Yeah, that's a whole other thing. But that's very nice, Joe. Thank you. But I feel like I can also definitely fall into that. And there are some movies that I'll watch and then later it's like, I feel like I overrated that by half a star. You know, like I didn't. That doesn't feel true, like what the rating I gave that movie, even if it's just like a really minor adjustment. I'm sure a lot of people have that experience. But yeah, with Silent Night, I mean, I had heard your reaction to it and I had seen early reviews for it. I was ready for it to not be great. But I did have, I think, more of like a fundamental issue with the film than I thought I was going to. But yeah, I guess I do have some things I'd love to talk about like what the part this plays in John Woo's career and kind of talking about that. But yeah, like as an action film, you have this kind of like John Woo style revenge plot, but the gimmick is that there's no dialogue. Like Joel Kinnaman's character gets shot in the throat by a gang member because he's chasing them. His son catches a stray bullet. I shouldn't say it like that. His son gets hit by a stray bullet.
His son was like, actively involved in the gang war, caught a stray bullet.
There's like a gang violence issue near his neighborhood and his son gets hit by a stray bullet. He dies. And so he wants to get revenge and he feels like the police aren't doing their job to kind of bring justice to that. But yeah, no dialogue because he loses his vocal cords. And what do you, I mean, that's kind of it. It's a revenge actioner and there's no dialogue. It's an interesting thing. We just saw it also in No One Will Save You, the alien flick that had pretty much no dialogue. And so how did you feel like that kind of exercise went?
Wow. Do you think question.
I know that you didn't love it entirely, but do you feel like it was mostly successful and kind of an interesting thing to experience?
In A Silent Night or No One Will Save You?
Oh, in Silent Night.
So I want to rewind for just 1 second. You did a good job explaining the plot. I always skip giving the plot out to people, so thank you for giving the plot. That is essentially the foundational premise of this movie.
Yeah, if you want to give a more detailed...
No, you got it. Summary, father seeks revenge on a gang for the death of his son. That is it. That is it. And there's no dialogue.
And his son was killed on Christmas Eve. So it's like he's training for a year and then the following year he plans to exact his revenge. So that's what makes it a Christmas movie.
Exactly. Rotten Tomato score right now is 59% for critics. There's no consensus or score for the audience just yet or as of the date of
that's
this recording.
That's rotten, right? 59 is rotten.
It is barely rotten. Before I answer your question, I want you to give me an answer to this question. What do you think the audience score will come in at?
Oof. Well, did you see it just got like a C or a C+ cinema score, which
I think it was a C
for something that literally looks like a revenge flick. And it is. That's not that good. I'm going to say it'll come in like the 60s.
Interesting.
Or 70s. People, ooh. I honestly am seeing more people than I thought giving it like 3 or 3.5 stars.
Oh, interesting. So, I feel like this. So it's just such an interesting thing about like the circles we keep and the circles that we kind of interact with. Cause I feel like the circles I've been around have mostly been like 2 to 3 stars. But a lot of the people I'm interacting with are people who are more heavily invested into the world of film. I'm thinking like, how does John and Jane Doe, who walk off the street, walk into AMC and pick a movie from the list, how are they going to react to this movie? Because I feel like those are the people that are more likely going to rate this movie on Rotten Tomatoes. I could see this movie coming in the 50 to 60 range. I think like 57, 58.
Wow. You think it really – why? Because you think it's – is it a pacing thing? I feel like people know it's dialogue-less. If you don't know there's no dialogue, good luck, Charlie. That's like – that would be such you a thought, like, all right.
I do think there's
going to
be a good amount of people who aren't aware it's dialogue-less.
Yeah. It just looks like a fun action movie. And it's like, looks from like a fun the producers movie. Of John Wick.
I mean, the trailer doesn't say no dialogue, does it?
I don't think it does.
I don't think it does. It just
and
like
the
a
synopsis
bunch of,
doesn't either.
No, it's just a bunch
it
of car chases.
It just says he loses his voice.
Exactly. And that implies that he doesn't talk, which is something that you also thought before going in or before I told you that it was just him who wasn't going to talk, not the entire cast.
Yes.
But it's the entire, like his wife
really
isn't talking.
I know. I feel like this is very, if you are listening, you have not seen it. No one talks. Like I really, I was like in the desert looking for an oasis when his wife, when he was sad and his wife would whisper like, hey, it's okay. That's like the only words that are spoken in the entire movie. They're in the same room and she'll like text him.
Okay. We need to rewind first 1 second. Because this is a perfect segue into the question you asked me earlier. And is this exercise in having no dialogue successful? Ultimately, I'm going to say no. I think that the dialogue in this, or the lack of dialogue in this movie, is more of a detriment to the overall pacing of the movie, to its, I mean, like, I understand its thesis is like actions speak louder than words. But there are so many times in this movie where you just get these really awkward interactions between Joel Kinnaman and his wife, or Joel Kinnaman and the cop, or even the gang members that he's interacting with, because you expect them to have a conversation, or not even a conversation, you just expect a normal person to say something. Like you said, she's like texting him in the same room, like, oh, you should probably go outside and touch grass. And he'll like look at his phone and like put it down. And there's just so many moments where they're like embracing each other, and no one's saying anything. And yeah. You would kind of expect her to kind of console him a little bit. You know, they lost their son. You expect
I know, so many
her to...
people are like, he lost his ability to speak, not to hear.
Exactly.
Like,
exactly.
How are they communicating with each other?
Exactly. And like, you kind of expect her to be saying things, like express her frustrations with him as he kind of falls into this pit of despair. But she doesn't, because the movie's so committed to this gimmick. And I feel like that constantly pulls people out. It pulled me out all the time. Mm-hmm. And so I think ultimately the no dialogue gimmick is more of a detriment. I don't think it works in this movie. I think it works in a movie like No One Will Save You, because it's that movie is set up in a way where she doesn't need to talk to anybody.
Right.
She's alone for most of the movie, if not, you know, 90% of it. In this movie, he's constantly interacting with people. So it's strange for him to interact with like a doctor and the doctor to just look him and like shake his head and move on. Like, it's a fucking doctor.
In certain moments, I guess it does have thematic significance, like the way he is silenced and like how communication can break down after the death of a child and stuff like that. But it also, I don't think it's worth it, because it keeps you at an arm's length from the characters, because they're just not acting how human beings would act. Like, if I was, you want to relate. Like, if I was in that situation, I would be sobbing and talking to him all the time.
Yeah, yeah. I don't understand the reason to make everybody silent. That's the like where I'm like, I don't get the connection there. I get making him silent. I understand that. Mm-hmm. And that does lend itself to a really cool thematic message.
Well, but that would even make it more impactful in contrast to everyone else being able to talk. Like, it doesn't, you don't really notice him as like this, you know, voiceless vigilante, because no one is speaking. And so I think they committed too hard to the bit.
they committed too hard to the bit. They flew too close to the dialogue-less sun. And they burnt
up. And that's
up
not John Woo's fault. Like, the script was obviously conceived this way. And I think that, you know, John Woo in interviews he's so adorable. I'm sure he talked about it, because you did it with a Q&A. You saw it with a Q&A with John Woo. We should mention that, because that's amazing and I'm jealous. But he was really, I think, excited to like, he's like, I wanted to do something different and unexpected. And I saw it as like a really interesting challenge. And I've always said this, but like back when I first watched one of his films, I was like, it really feels like his action is a language. Like John Woo could tell a whole story just through gun fu and fists and explosions. But it doesn't need to be taken this literally.
Wow, what a segue to the next question I have for you. I mentioned earlier, the ultimate like thesis is the actions are supposed to speak louder than words. But does it? Is the action good enough in Silent Night to carry a movie? Like you said, the previous Woo films, you do feel like the gung fu, the fist fights, the explosions could tell a story on its own. But could the action in Silent Night tell the story on its own?
I didn't know. I guess I – and that was something that was really hard for me to kind of come to terms with, was like, no, I didn't even think – there is like no aspect of this that I'm like, this is a John Woo film that mm-hmm. I want to return to for the action, even if I didn't love the movie that much. I don't think it's really – doing anything particularly like narratively significant with how the action plays out. There's like a cool fake oneer up a staircase at the end that I think is probably the best scene that we get.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I mean, I know a lot of people are having a problem with like a big chunk in the middle of the film just being like a training montage. and I didn't have actually a problem with that, but you're not getting like big action set pieces. Did you think that was really annoying that it took up too much time?
I thought it was funny because if your movie is going to be, I'm not going to have any dialogue to force the audience to focus on the visuals and focus on the action to tell the story, I would imagine you would need to have the action consistent enough to tell that story. But there is that chunk that, I don't know, maybe 45 minutes, maybe half hour chunk of the movie that's really dedicated to Kinnaman's character training. He's doing pull-ups. He's learning how to shoot a gun. He's learning how to drive a car. He's writing on his calendar, start a gang war. He's, you know, actively trying to plan this takedown. And it really just brings the movie to like a alarming stop. And it doesn't feel like it's going anywhere. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, a year has passed. And now he's going to get his revenge.
Uh-huh.
It's a strange decision to make when you don't have any dialogue and you decide not to have any action. It's really weird.
It is weird. His wife, when his wife eventually leaves him, I was like, thank God. Because there was just nothing narratively interesting going on with that. I was like,
no.
I keep, you know, thinking about like what's, you know, how is that going to work out? But if you're going to play straight revenge actioner, just do it. Like, don't, you know, waste time with stuff that isn't going to interest the viewer.
Exactly. And I know a lot of people keep saying, well, this is a normal person. He's not John Wick. He's not naturally talented killer where he can just, you know, go down to his basement and pull out this case of guns and go ham. He has to take his time to become a killer.
Well, and so do you think it is truly just a script issue here?
I mean, when you get down to the bare bones of this all, I think so. Because like you mentioned, the action itself, nothing about it is like screaming woo. There's a couple of moments that is definitely like a homage or an allusion to a different woo movie. And that oneer, the fake oneer on the staircase is, you know, a fun watch. But the action itself, fairly generic, uninspired. Nothing about it is like screaming like, whoa, that was worth the wait for 45 minutes. So when you get down to the bones of it, like the skeleton of the movie, the script is so awful. And we haven't even talked about like the other terrible aspects of the script. No dialogue is bad, but even its story that's rooted in like this, I was gonna say low key, but maybe high key, conservative like vendetta against caricatures of gangs and stereotypical like Latinx communities, it's pretty bad, man. It's not a good look.
I will say, for me, probably my biggest issue with this movie is that I did not like Joel Kinnaman's character at all. I actually thought he was being extremely evil, So I think that is kind of what – that the whole film, I just had this feeling of like discomfort in that I didn't find what he was doing justified. And I genuinely came out of the movie being like, was I supposed to be rooting for this person? And like you – yeah, I mean you hit the nail on the head. It's like this very trivial look at gang violence and basically that – you know, his son was killed, and so now he's just going to murder everyone in cold blood that he encounters who, like, resembles a gang member. And it seems like they're doing things like, oh, but they're mugging a woman right before they get killed, so, like, it's cool. But that's not really that works.
That's the problem with it, is that it's, like, it's weirdly playing on this, like, stereotypical fear that gangs are infiltrating our neighborhoods and you better watch right. out because a stray bullet might kill your son.
Well, and so here's the thing with that is that I think a lot of people will be like, you know, who cares? It's like, it's a movie. But then I think it becomes a tonal issue in that John Woo made the choice. Like, he's talked about his choice to take this film very seriously. A lot of John Woo, especially his American films, have a totally unserious tone. The action is very outlandish and fantastical, and it's awesome and it's super fun. And I'm not saying that he can't trek into this darker territory, because he has. Did you see Bullet in the Head? Was that one of the ones that you watched?
I've never seen Bullet in the Head, no.
But you watched A Better Tomorrow, which I know deals with some heavier political stuff, right?
Yeah, but that's what I like about John Woo, is like A Better Tomorrow, where like it takes like this gang member. He's the leader of a gang member. But he is a leader of a gang member. He's a leader of a gang but he's like a good guy. Like, he's not doing anything to put civilians in harm's way. He's actively putting himself in a position of danger to protect people who are innocent. And this cop sees that. And like, they develop this really interesting relationship with each other, where like the cop wants to uphold justice, but realizes like the system is broken. And so it leads to this really interesting relationship between the two characters. And I thought that's where this movie was going. And it kind of like scratches that surface with Kid Cudi's character and Joel Kinnaman's character. But again, there's no fucking dialogue
There's no dialogue. They just stare at each other.
And there's no attempt to develop that relationship or develop those characters.
Exactly. And so, yeah, I wanted to bring up like that John Woo has done, like Bullet in the Head is a movie that's being brought up a lot, where people are like, this isn't like people on Twitter who I respect their opinion a lot, who liked the film. They're very familiar with like the action world and John Woo's films. They're like, you know, I think people are expecting like a fun Hollywood John Woo film, but this is more like Bullet in the Head. But Bullet in the Head is like John Woo's Apocalypse Now. It's dealing with very complicated and nuanced themes of like war and violence. I mean, so, and when he writes his own scripts, it's like profound shit, dude. Like the relationships that he creates, like you said, between, you know, it's like this, the moral ambiguity of like the role of the police and, you know, the cop-assassin relationship. Man, I mean, his films are really affecting. And you can see bits of what he's put into his other films here. Like in the beginning, you hear on the radio, they're talking about inflation. And you see, you know, these images of kind of like a society in decay. And I was like, okay, are we kind of addressing, you know, the roots of gang violence? Are we maybe going to look at that? Like, yes, he's been wronged, but there are these societal issues that are creating these problems as well at large. But it kind of just gets totally abandoned. It becomes, yeah, like this bloodbath of him just killing these totally stereotypical representations of these things. And so I think it really felt like John Woo was working against a script that really just had nothing going on. I mean, when you're seeing Joel Kinnaman filled with such rage against these gangs, and he's in his wife has left him, he's totally isolated, he's in his basement watching videos of like two white guys teaching you on YouTube how to lethally stab someone wearing like American flag t-shirts. I'm like, how am I supposed to perceive this? Yeah. I'm not even going to say anything about it. I'm like, it's very clearly laid out in front of me, and I genuinely don't know how to interpret what's going on. I just know that I don't like this character. I'm not like, hell yeah, go get him, you know? Yeah. And so I think it is that really serious, grounded approach to the material that, like, with John Wick, you're like, fuck yeah, they killed your dog, John Wick. Like, go, you know, kill everyone because you're this, you know, impenetrable assassin guy, and it's just fun, and it's like there's comedy in it and there's this fantastical aspect to it. But I just found this movie like really depressing. Did you feel like it was like a bummer?
It was a bummer. And you know what would really help this movie?
What?
If they fucking talked. That's what would help. There's not enough there for us to chew on. And so when we do watch his character, watch YouTube videos of how to fatally kill somebody, It's hard to root for the guy completely.
It
is a bummer of a movie. When we talk about the ending, that kind of final showdown with the leader of the gang, it's like you get this moment where he stares into a Christmas ornament and he sees a reflection of his son, or he sees his son in the ornament. And I thought at that point he wasn't going to kill the gang member, but he still does.
Right. I thought he was having some internal crisis of like, is this the right thing to do? Like, do I want my son up in heaven seeing me do this or something? But then he kills him and then he dies.
He kills him anyways and he dies.
It was a murder-suicide, bro. Like,
so, I don't really understand.
Did you like the ending?
No, not really.
I liked that he died, because I was just like, I was like, we need to just be done with this entire mess. Like, he's murdered half the city. He would go to jail for this. His wife left him. His kid's dead. Like, just end it.
I like that he dies. I think the final showdown with the leader of the gang was fairly anticlimactic. I like the staircase scene leading up to it. I like when Kid Cudi pulls out both pistols and like does his thing.
Dual wield for a sec.
But the final, like, final boss battle that he has with this guy, I found really unenjoyable. The guy is the most caricature of a gang member you've ever seen before. He's like, he's tatted up, he's like doing loads of cocaine,
he's like, you know, injecting heroin into his girlfriend. I'm like, these just feel like weirdly inserted moments to be like, look, this guy's super evil and he deserves to die.
It feels like the research they did was like, let's Google like cliche bad guys, and they just put every cliche trope into this scene. And the final like battle itself, the final fight scene, wasn't anything to remember. I mean, if I'm being honest, I can't remember the details of it right now. I like that the decision of have him dying, because that's the only proper way for him to go. Because what do you do after that? I found like the actual final minutes of the movie where we see the letter he wrote to his wife, and it's just kind of like a Star Wars title crawl of like us reading the letter. I was like, why am I doing all this work right now to read this letter? Oh, I know why. Because this movie has no dialogue, so I have to read the letter myself.
Uh-huh.
Which I was, at that point in the movie, I was like, I don't even care what the letter says. I really don't.
I know, and I truly didn't know what I was supposed to feel. Like, are we supposed to be sad that he died?
I wasn't.
Are we supposed to be happy that he got his revenge? No, not really. I mean, I just didn't care about him.
Wow. Is there any silver lining to this movie?
No, it honestly makes me nervous, because John Woo did another interview recently where he said that he has a tough time getting Hollywood scripts compared to his American counterparts, because he's Chinese, because he's not American. And I just really hope that negative reception won't exacerbate that problem. I truly just think this is a bad, I mean, I am a little bit, I'm like, man, like, why did you, I can see why he picked the script, and I don't think it worked out, but he still got it, dude. He's 77. Like, it's impressive.
I think it's impressive as well. I think there are things to still admire on a technical level. I like the John Woo like transitions. I like the way he uses his camera.
Exactly.
There are still things that has that John Woo flair that I think is missing in Hollywood action movies. And it's good to have him involved in those types of movies and see how like a different auteur can come in and, you know, give his take on an action movie. I still like that kind of stuff. I think that's really fun.
It's very style. There are a lot of cool stylistic moments in this film. I think that's the silver lining.
Yeah, and that I can appreciate. And like I said, some of the action scenes are still fun. They're brutal. There's that one scene he fights like the like bodyguard or head boss of the gang, not the main gang leader, but the. Remember where the gang leader called like texts his friend like, "Hey, kill this guy right now in this video." He has a cool like. One showdown with him in like one of the drug rooms, and so like there are moments that I found myself really enjoying it, but besides those silver linings, I felt like it is probably up there cracking into my top 10 of disappointing movies of the year.
Yeah,
you know, you and I were really hyped for this movie. The trailer played before I saw like Saw X or something, and I was like, oh, I'm all in on this, but. Yeah, not a great movie, not a movie I loved. I am concerned about the future of Wu. You know, this compounded with the fact of what you said, that he's already having a hard time getting jobs, and compounded on the fact that, like, recently, maybe like 3 weeks ago, he was quoted saying he doesn't care for, like, Marvel movies. He doesn't care for superhero movies.
Yeah, I know. Isn't that so annoying? Because in the interview, it was, like, the sweetest, like, most passive remark that he's like, yeah, I don't really watch Marvel movies. Like, I really like older cinema. I'm just old-fashioned. And that was it. And then it became, like, this big headline.
Yeah,
that
of course.
That upset all the Marvel fans.
Yeah, it becomes another headline of, like, oh, another 70-year-old director doesn't like Marvel movies. And, you know... more mainstream audiences will see that and then see this movie and say, fuck you, your movie sucks.
Exactly.
And that's, I'm also concerned about that because we're Wu heads here. We love Wu. We love the stuff he's made. Yeah. He is a talented guy. He will go down as like one of the greatest action directors ever, probably.
I think he is.
There he goes. Sydney thinks he is.
Well, I know. And I said in one of my reviews that it's like, I think there is a difference between the greatest action director and the greatest director of action. And I think Wu clears like everyone when it comes to literally directing action, whether you want to say, you know, best director who makes action movies is like a different conversation. But you know what the good thing is that he is, I hope this is still happening, but he's making a remake of his own movie, The Killer.
Oh, fun.
With two female leads.
Okay.
It's like my prayers have been answered because I watch his films and I'm like, man, I'd love to see like a kick-ass
a woman?
Female lead in John Woo film. I know all the women are always there and they're just like in Hard Target. The woman finally gets to shoot someone and one of the guys is like, give me that. And I'm like, man. And then she does. I'm like, this isn't right.
I mean, he is an older director coming out of the 80s and 90s. But I think a remake of The Killer is a really fun and smart idea.
I think that, man, I'm so psyched for that.
How many more John Wicks does Stahelski need to direct for you to... be convinced he is the new director, the best director of action?
He's definitely up there. It is hard because like Stahelski is so good with like hand-to-hand combat type stuff and like stunts, but John Woo is just like transcend, like his set pieces are like transcendent. Like how do you even, I mean, the end of Hardboiled, he's doing like hour-long, meticulously crafted events that I don't think anyone has reached that level again.
Yeah, and Stahelski has said on multiple occasions that Wu is like one of his inspirations and continues to be one of his inspirations. John Woo 4 is definitely inspired by Wu.
And that's why it's annoying that everyone's calling this like, oh, it's just like some John Wick ripoff without really knowing who directed it. Because it's like, it's literally directed by the guy that John Woo was inspired or John Wick was inspired by.
Exactly.
It's more complicated than that.
Yeah, so I guess the ultimate or the final word I'll have for this is that for me, it was disappointing. I gave it 2 stars out of 5. I think that there is still a level of visual storytelling that Wu has that no one else has and that can be appreciated. But when you boil down the script and some of the decisions made with the dialogue-less story and a lot of other things, it's not my favorite movie of the year, for sure.
Yeah, I'm with you. I also ended up giving it 2 stars ultimately, because I agree. It just, it sucks. I wish I liked it more, but I do think it just, the script, it just doesn't really work. And I think, yeah, the way that it handles the subject matter. I mean, yeah, I haven't really talked to anyone at length about it. Yeah, and there's definitely some like sensitive things that people are going to be discussing about it. But I do think it's just the way that it handled the story just made me feel confused, I think, at the end of the day. So I wasn't able to fully enjoy the action. So I'm curious to hear what more people think about it, what the audience score ends up being. And if you haven't watched any John Woo films, now's the time.
What's number one recommendation?
Hardboiled. That's the best action movie of all time.
Well, it's tough to recommend a movie like Hardboiled or even The Killer when it's impossible to find. Where do they even go watch it?
Message me individually. I will provide you with places to watch.
I'm going to bleep out this part of the podcast.
I will, you know what? And even if we don't want to say that, I will personally mail you my Criterion copy of Hardboiled. I'm dead serious.
Even that copy is hard to find now.
The quality isn't even that great. I know, and that's why in an interview someone was like, do you see, you know, are there conversations about getting your older Hong Kong action films on, like, for getting 4K releases? And he's like, no, because I don't own the rights anymore.
It's wild to me, man. I know, isn't that?
And I think that's why he's such a great action director who has yet to be discovered by so many Western audiences, because his films just aren't very accessible. But he has, I mean, his American action movies are so much fun. I mean, I've liked all of the ones that I've watched. And of course he did Face Off.
Of course, the Face Off. Yeah. I guess if I were to recommend one, start with Face Off, because it's the most accessible one, not only in terms of finding it somewhere to rent or buy, but also, you know, familiar faces in terms of Travolta and Cage. And so that might be a really good way to kind of transition into the world of Woo. I love The Killer, big fan of The Killer,
so good.
That's another movie where it's like fucking hard to find.
I know.
I'll just say, message Sydney or yo ho yo ho.
What?
Fire is life for me.
What are you referencing? I'm not saying that we support that here, but
no,
we do. I do.
If you have to walk the plank, though, it's not on me. Let's switch gears. Let's talk about Godzilla Minus One, baby. This was a movie that came out on December 1st as well. Here's your summary. It's one sentence, two sentences. In post-war Japan, a new terror arises. Will the devastated people be able to survive, or let alone fight back? It's an interesting summary, but
I think it speaks to the simplistic brilliance of this film.
I want to clarify for people who are listening, because I think that I received a few comments kind of questioning where this Godzilla fits in our current world of Godzilla in the States. So Godzilla is being made here actively by Legendary or Warner Brothers. I think both of them. We're getting Godzilla versus Kong next year. There's a Godzilla show on Apple TV. Godzilla Minus One has nothing to do with that. Just very clear.
Yeah, exactly.
No relation to anything that's happening here. There's no plans for a Godzilla cinematic universe. These two Godzillas won't meet. This is completely separate. This Godzilla is made by Toho Entertainment, which is based in Japan. And this is, They do this every, like, I don't want to say decade, but I can't remember when Shin Godzilla was. It feels like it was more than 10 years ago, though.
I think it was 2015.
So we're getting close to 10 years now.
2016.
So every 8 to 10 years, Toho will put out a new Godzilla movie. You know, they do whatever they want. I mean, they've done, you know, a lot of Godzilla movies in the past. So Godzilla Minus One is, just for clarification's sake, no relation to the whatever's happening here in the States. I want to make that very clear.
Well, it's good that you're saying that, because I had people, it's so funny. We'll talk about, you know, how we felt about the film, but I was posting about how great I thought it was. And I had some people who aren't super into film that were like, is this a joke? Like, is it actually that good? I just feel like Godzilla movies have been mid for a while. And I was like, yeah, well, it wasn't made by Hollywood.
Exactly. And that's why I wanted to clarify, because there are people who are going to say, like, wait a minute, like the last two or three Godzilla movies have been like really mid or worse. And they've all had like not so great word of mouth. And it just, you know, have been CGI mm-hmm. fests of just like fist fights. And that's fine for, you know, for a different type of movie. But this is a very, very different Godzilla movie. And it is it the biggest surprise of the year? What do you think?
I wouldn't say this isn't even something that I would consider a surprise, because I didn't have expectations. It was more something I like kind of saw was coming out when I was doing my release schedule. And then all of a sudden it was just this wave of like insanely positive reactions. And I was like, whoa, like this completely came out of nowhere. And I think that's so exciting when a film, especially a foreign film, it's like the RRR effect when this
yes.
film manages to break through into the mainstream. It's just so reliably incredible, and everyone is loving it, and everyone, you know, the word of mouth really takes effect. It's always like a cool thing to be part of.
So currently it sits at a 97% critic score and a 98% audience score.
That's crazy.
So we're not even exaggerating in terms of the reaction to this movie has been overwhelmingly positive from both sides, critics and audiences. Mm-hmm. Why do you think people are loving this movie? What it about Godzilla Minus One is turning people's heads and realizing, oh shit, there is a side of this world that is actually good. It's not just like big monkey fight big lizard.
Wow. Well, I liked what you mentioned in your review, that I feel like what has happened with any American release that's dealing with like big monsters or like big robots, that you don't care about the human characters. That is specifically, I think, what makes Godzilla. I mean, we'll talk about Godzilla, but really getting you invested in the human story is what puts Godzilla Minus One into that top tier of like the blockbuster experience, I think. I mean, do you think that's kind of the main reason?
When I look back at like Godzilla, well, if you go all the way back to the first American adaptation, Godzilla 1998, which sure, it was about characters, but that was such a like abomination of like taking Godzilla, changing the image to kind of fit a more American aesthetic, putting Godzilla in New York. Have you seen that movie, 1998 version?
No, I haven't.
It's a movie, but they definitely changed so much of it because I think they realized.
Yeah, why does it look like that?
My theory is that since this is the first like big American adaptation, like blockbuster Hollywood pouring money to Godzilla. And Godzilla prior to this had always been like a guy in a costume or like very rudimentary, kind of crude looking Godzilla. Mm-hmm. And I think that they wanted to really like, look at America. We can flex our CGI, our VFX, and we're going to change this look Godzilla to make it look more appealing to American audiences. And so they gave it like a longer snout. They made it more lizard like. And that's my theory. I mean, there may be a more concrete answer. Exactly. I think they wanted to make it more.
Going on the Jurassic Park hype?
Yes. No, I'm serious. I think they were trying to go on the more like Jurassic Park came out in 95. We know that was successful. Let's try to mimic that aesthetic and people will be more inclined to go watch it. Mm-hmm. And the movie's bad. The movie's just is not good. But it is a movie that did try to focus more on the characters, you know, Matthew Broderick and company. Not good movie, though. And then you get like Godzilla versus Kong. Godzilla, King of Monsters. Like, there are characters in the movie. Like, Millie Bobby Brown's in it, but I don't know who she is. I don't know who her dad is. I don't know who her mom is. Like, I know who the actors are, but I don't know who they are. Like, those human characters really mean nothing. Now, I will say, Godzilla 2014, the Gareth Edwards one, is the only American adaptation that did try to explore Godzilla as a symbol more than any other American adaptation.
Okay. And well, what is that symbol? Because I must admit, I've not seen that movie since it came out when I was a young lad. So
it's similar in the sense that like Godzilla is fighting the Mutos, which are creatures that have been created from a nuclear fallout, and they go around trying to consume more nuclear power. And so it's trying to make a statement about the power of nuclear weapons and how they can have these devastating consequences. And so I think that movie is trying to explore that realm. It's not as successful as something like mm-hmm. Minus One or as the original Godzilla. But I think why Godzilla Minus One, to kind of bring it full circle, is that why it's so successful and why we're talking about this is because it opens up with like this character, and he is a kamikaze plane flyer. No, is that the right word? Plane
kamikaze
flyer?
Kamikaze pilot?
Pilot.
Okay.
Plane flyer? He's a kamikaze pilot who has abandoned his post during World War II and then encounters Godzilla, and we kind of follow him. And you know, like, it is a Godzilla movie, but Godzilla only has like three big appearances in the movie.
Yeah, there are big, long stretches of just these characters, like, dealing with real human issues mm-hmm. and living their lives. And it's so incredibly engrossing.
Exactly. And so I think that is why so many people are like falling head over heels with this movie, is because there is a strong emotional core to it.
Mm-hmm.
You are connected to this pilot, to kind of this found family aspect where he meets this woman. They adopt this kid. You know, they don't really have this romantic relationship in the beginning, and it kind of blossoms into something different. You meet all these like interesting post-war generals and scientists and engineers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're dealing with the fallout of losing the war. It's really layered with so many interesting characters and yeah. themes that it makes the movie interesting to watch even when Godzilla's not on the screen.
Exactly. And then it's like, I feel like, yeah, like Hollywood oftentimes misunderstands what people actually want to see. And sometimes I don't think audiences even know why they love the blockbusters that they love. It's not because you're watching Godzilla destroy shit for 2 hours. I think that even makes it overexposed, you know? So you don't truly feel like there's a real gravity to the destruction that he's causing, when that's just kind of what the movie is about. But in this film, I mean, it establishes stakes, and you really feel – I thought this movie was terrifying. And I don't know if – it could have just been because I saw it in 4DX. I want to see it. Did you see it in IMAX?
I saw it in IMAX, just normal IMAX.
It's not playing in IMAX near me.
But I saw it before – because I think what happened is the Renaissance Tour movie took all the IMAX screens.
Uh-huh.
And I think it was only in IMAX for like that Thursday and Wednesday night. And that was it.
Okay. This was the first time that I was in a movie. I was in Godzilla and I could hear the Renaissance Tour through the walls.
Oh, no way.
It was pretty distracting, actually. Yeah.
But you saw it in 4DX. Was that a big difference for you?
So I would like to see it in IMAX again, not only because I'd love to see the movie again, but just to compare. I know I'm like, all day I was like, how do I talk about 4DX without being like the most annoying person on the planet? But I loved it, dude.
I thought it was so
fun and cool. Have you done it before?
Never done 4DX, but I know it's like the one where they spray water at you when there's like water.
Yeah, but it's not. I know some people said that they found it really annoying at some. I think it depends on the movie. Like there wasn't. I didn't get water sprayed at me, but they do like wind. And dude, there's shit like touching your ankles and stuff.
What? They touch your ankles?
Dude, it's wild. I'm like, why is no one talking about this? Like, when did they start doing 4DX? Because I never even thought about doing it. I only did it now because I was like, you know what? I don't want to see it not in IMAX, but I want to see it. So let's take a shot at 4DX. And yeah, the chairs are moving around. Every time Godzilla bit someone, two things would like stab into my back. Like, it's trying to make you feel like he's biting. Yes. It's insane. It's literally insane.
That's kind of cool.
It's really cool. And so it's like, I understand people finding it distracting, and it's definitely not something I would want to do all the time. I think I get why people say, like, you should use it to see, like, the new Fast and Furious movie, not a movie you want to really, like, pay attention to. But for Godzilla, like, because so much of it is that human story, the seats, I mean, it's not doing anything to you during those moments because it's just kind of like quiet time. And then the Godzilla scenes happen. I was like, dude.
Well, this is another good transition to the Godzilla scenes, because we talked about how maybe the movie's initial draw, or how do I say this? We talked about how people might be loving this more than the Hollywood versions because there is a really strong human component.
Uh-huh.
But that is not to say the Godzilla component is lacking.
It's, yeah. It's,
I mean, arguably, I haven't seen every Godzilla movie. I've seen a lot of them. I haven't seen all of them. But I, from what I've seen, this is probably the most terrifying, most devastating version of Godzilla I have ever seen.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
I mean, it's like, yeah, it just, I don't know. For me, it was that feeling of like, just, it was nice to be in a theater and feel that like electrifying experience of seeing something of that spectacle, that like that scale up on the big screen and really like feeling it. You know, I feel like I haven't felt that in a while from a movie like this. Yeah, and he, I mean, the effects are really good.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. I'm blown away.
So the big scene for me that I found the most powerful, the most devastating, the most hard, you know, kind of hard to watch, was the when Godzilla destroys, I believe the part of the country is called Ginza. And it's when the main girl, Noroki, she like quote unquote dies, and Godzilla shows up and he's, you know, destroying all these buildings, and there's reporters on top of the buildings trying to watch him, and, you know, they all die. We get this moment where it's the first time he uses his atomic breath, and he uses it, and it is like,
dude,
you could feel it like in your bones. Like my bones are rattling when this atomic breath is shot
out. That is such a good way to say it. I was like, how do I describe this? It literally feels like my skeleton is fucking shaking.
And it really made you feel like the destructive force of Godzilla.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It's incredible.
Well said. It is incredible. I mean, it's not, we're not exaggerating. Like that's what people have been, there were so many scenes that they ended. My jaw was just on the floor. I'm like, I hope no one's looking at me like right now because I look like an idiot, just like stunned by how epic those scenes are and how scary they are. Yeah.
How do you feel about the finale of the movie, or like the last 20 minutes, a kind of big final showdown with Godzilla and the ships and the pilot and the plane? How do you feel about that final scene?
So that's, I guess that ties into like there are a lot of aspects of this movie. Some people have been saying it's like, I don't know if the words I saw were like basic or generic. I think like structurally it definitely has a very like standard narrative structure. But there were a lot of things in this movie that I thought were very like interesting and unique. And I don't know if I've really seen a blockbuster deal with what you mentioned earlier of how he was a kamikaze pilot. He pretended to have, you know, mechanical issues with his ship because he didn't want to die. He didn't want to, go on that suicide mission of being a kamikaze pilot. I've never really seen it dealt with in that way where he's just feeling shame. Not only that he's feeling shame, but it goes against this blockbuster trend of things being resolved way too easily. Like the girl that he's raising this child with, she sacrifices herself for him because she is brave and he's not. Yeah. And it happens again and again that he has opportunities to be brave and he's not. And halfway through the film, I was like, damn, he's a coward. Like they're really like making him a coward, and they're not afraid of like doing that to this person that we're supposed to be invested in and in liking as this main character, because that's what it's about. It's about kind of his journey, like, you know, it's kind of like making that ultimate sacrifice, but it also is debunking the notion that courage means death.
Exactly.
That I think is very programmed into people in times of war, in that if you don't want to die, that's like cowardly for some reason. And it's not. And there are some really great lines in this film of like this country thinks of life treats life too cheaply or something. And so, yeah, there's this great communal effort of like the citizens, and it goes back to like citizen autonomy and how they are kind of coming together. They're taking matters into their own hands. And I thought it I couldn't believe how radical it felt, where they were like, you know what? No one has to die when we do this. Did you think that felt unique? Even though I feel like it shouldn't, I was like, oh, wow, that's like kind of insane.
Absolutely agree. It does feel unique, which is so strange to say. I get it. Because you're like, oh, it's not a radical thing to say you shouldn't have to die and be seen as cowardly. But that's how people were viewed, and it's especially in a time of war. Like, if you were unwilling to die for your country, then you are a coward.
Exactly. I mean, even in Western war epics, it's like, oh, yeah, we're going to die for our country. Like, that's just how it goes. That's just the norm. That's just how it goes, you know? And this movie is like, we don't want to accept that.
Exactly. And it challenges that. And it's what makes the ending so much more powerful, because you do expect him to ram the plane into Godzilla's mouth and sacrifice himself and blow up. And that's what a typical Hollywood movie would do. They would have had him fly that plane right into Godzilla, have him die for the cause and kill Godzilla and show to everybody he's brave and that he is willing to sacrifice for, right, quote unquote, the greater good. But he lives. He shoots out of the plane via the ejection seat and lives, because living, like, you don't have to kill yourself to be brave. And I think that's like what's so powerful about the ending. It's so Hollywood, so American to have you die for your country.
Right.
And maybe not, and it's not just Hollywood or American. I mean, obviously this movie is from Japan, so they're making that criticism of that trope as well. But think of all these like classic American blockbusters. The first one that comes to my head is Independence Day, where at the very end of Independence Day, you get the drunkard veteran who has the last missile to kill and blow up the alien ship. Oh no, the missile jammed. He can no longer shoot it. So what does he do? He rams his jet into the mothership and blows it up, killing himself and the aliens. It is like the most cliche American die for your country message. And this is, yeah, that's what I agree completely is why this movie is so powerful, is that it's like reminding people that you don't need to die. There's so many moments where characters like, I think it's the engineer who tells the fighter pilot, live, like, yeah, don't die, live, come back and live, like, come back and be a father. Like, there's no reason for you to die. You don't have to die.
Right.
And it's like really, really emotional. Did you cry?
Yeah, I did a couple times. Did you?
I got teary eyed towards the end. I didn't like full on cry, but I am curious if I would cry a second time once I'm like more. I did see it kind of late. It was like 10:30 at night.
I was, you did a go sleepy late, yeah.
But I feel, yeah, like if I saw it a second time, I'd cry.
It's powerful stuff. It felt very refreshing. And it were, I mean, it just works thematically so perfectly, because they were talking about, you know, this country has treated life so cheaply. They're giving us planes that like don't have ejection seats. But this plane that never ended up like getting used in war, he's like, this has an ejection seat. Use it. Like, choose, mm-hmm, to live. And it just
choose to live.
Yeah. I thought it was great that it was like this totally citizens. A couple times I was like, how the hell, like, how are they funding this giant thing that they're doing? But, you know, the sentiment stands that it's like this citizen created effort to take down Godzilla. And I think it feels so powerful because Hollywood can do Godzilla and Hollywood can do cool monster movies, but Godzilla is such an important part of Japanese culture because it represents something that's so specific to them and what happened, mm-hmm, to them in the aftermath of World War II and Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so I think you really feel that behind this, yeah, film and how hopeful it is and how impassioned it is about what it's trying to say.
Oh, absolutely. Some of my favorite scenes in this movie are just conversations between this group of people that we learn to love. You know, like I said, you have like the pilot, a general, an engineer, a scientist. You also have this like younger kid who is, they call him the kid, who's never been to war.
Yeah.
And he's so hell-bent on going to war. He's like, I want to fight. I want to fight. And one of the most poignant and powerful lines to me is when one of the older guys goes like, not going to war is something to be proud of.
Right.
And it's like, it's just so refreshing because it is just this constant reminder that like so many people during war times are brainwashed into thinking that war is necessary. And if you go to war, it's an honor to fight for your country. When in reality, it's like, it's hell and people die. And people die for no reason sometimes, or people die for the greed of people, or people die because people are lazy. Like, it's a hellish landscape, and Godzilla is like the physical embodiment of that, and the movie just captures it so perfectly.
Yeah, it's really, yeah, I just love that message. It reminds me, yeah, it's like this romanticization of like suffering. And, you know, David Lynch is a director who is very passionate about the notion that you don't have to suffer in order to create great art.
Mm-hmm.
And I see them as kind of related. Like, it's like, you don't, if you want to live, that doesn't make you a coward. I want to live, bro. I'm not going to die happily for anything.
I agree. I also want to point out, when I gave this movie 4 stars, I really liked it a lot. I don't want to get that misconstrued or misinterpreted. But I was talking to Sydney, and we were talking about the ending. And so the very end, the pilot, I don't know his name. I should have wrote his name down, but I didn't. But he goes to the hospital because he gets word that, you know, his, I guess, partner or love interest. I mean, they don't really express any romance until the end.
Yeah.
But he goes, and she's alive, and she's like, you know, in a sling, and she has like her head bandaged up. And there's a quick shot of something on her neck. And I didn't really understand what that was, if I'm being honest. I was like, oh, I don't know, it said something. And it wasn't until I looked it up on Wikipedia that it's implying that she has radiation sickness from what had just happened. And now I'm like doubling back and thinking, oh, maybe this is, I like the ending a lot more than I realized. Because I thought for a second it tied up too perfectly with a bow. I thought it was a little too neat to have her actually survive the big catastrophe in Ginza. And I was like, not a huge fan of her surviving, if I'm being completely honest, because I thought that was a little bit of a cheap way to end the movie.
No,
but
I'm
knowing,
kind of, yeah,
but
yeah,
knowing that she had just radiation sickness and that she's actually just going to be doomed in the future, I think that's a really powerful statement to make about, yeah, you may survive catastrophe. You may survive like the coming of Godzilla, or you may survive a nuclear weapon, but it doesn't mean like you will have no effect of like what just happened.
Right. Like there's still collateral damage.
There's still collateral damage.
And exploring that metaphor further, because it is, the thing on her neck like resembles Godzilla's like kind of like taily, like spiky things.
So I said that just to say that I'm going to increase my score to 4.5. That's all I wanted to say. That's why I was bringing
as
it up.
As you should. No, but you know, I think that 4 is a totally fair rating for, like, it is a film that I feel like I could watch it again and be like, okay, like it, you know, I'm starting to pick up on a couple things that aren't, you know, absolutely perfect. The reason why I didn't love the ending is because it was like setting up, do you think it was setting up a sequel? And then I was like, I was really processing this emotionally. And then it's like, come back for part 2.
It shows like Godzilla's like brain reforming, or like his body reforming and reshaping. I think that I don't know for a fact, but I wouldn't be surprised if every single Japanese version of Godzilla never had this like concrete ending, because they always want to keep the idea of bringing him back alive. I don't think Godzilla Minus One is this indication that they'll bring back this particular Godzilla next year or even 2 years. I wouldn't be surprised if he came back in like 6 to 5 years. That would make sense. And I wouldn't be upset by that. I don't think they're like trying to imply here's a new franchise to watch out for. I could be wrong.
Well, maybe if it was a wrong Hollywood movie, I think it would be a given. So it could just be my brain being so used to that. But it, you know, it also just works as this message that like, hey, it's not over.
It's never
just
over.
Because they defeated, you know, Godzilla in this way doesn't mean, kind of bringing you back into reality and like what it is all actually representing. Like we're still suffering the effects of this.
Yeah, I think if you read it as like, if Godzilla is a symbol for nuclear warfare, you could read it as like, you could defeat it for the day, for the month, for the year. It'll always come back.
Right.
And I think if you read it that way, I don't mind it.
Well, dude, that's why this is a crazy thing to come out so close to Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
It is that kind of answer of like, yeah, the Japanese perspective of these events and the effects that it's had on them. And yeah.
My last question to you about Godzilla Minus One. The movie was made on a $15 million budget.
Uh-huh.
15 million, 15 for people listening, not 50, 15 budget. That's about a quarter of like every, maybe less than a quarter of almost every big American blockbuster, Hollywood blockbuster now. What do you think there'll be a Hollywood response to this in a sense that like they'll try to mimic this at all? Do you think they'll take this and try to do something like this?
No, I also like, I've seen interesting conversations about that online because it is like a conversion factor. I've also seen people saying like, you know, the VFX, you know, worker, you know, overworking issue we have in the US, it's even worse in Japan. So they're like getting away with doing certain things for cheaper. But I also think that Marvel movies are money laundering schemes. So
the Marvels cost over $200 million, apparently.
Yeah, there's a nuanced truth to the $15 million budget situation. But I mean, but still, it's not like somehow $15 million is the equivalent to us spending like $400 million on a fucking Fast X movie. Like, yeah, it's crazy. I mean, all you have to do to not spend that much money. Well, but Godzilla also doesn't show up that much in the film. And it's not like all the VFX are absolutely seamless, but it's like when they have to be good, they're good. He's not in the film that much. You shoot on location. It's really not that hard to not spend $500 million on a movie.
It's not. And Godzilla Minus One, I hope, is a wake-up call to Hollywood. That is my ultimate, like, prayer for Hollywood when they see this movie. I hope this movie kicks ass at the box office. And when it does, I hope Hollywood goes like, oh, we don't have to dump $175 million into every blockbuster. You know, and The Creator is a really good example of, like, a movie that costs $80 million, you know, yeah, it didn't do well, but that could be, you know, the strike was going on. The movie also was just okay. But it is an example of like, look, you could do it. You could make a good sci-fi movie for less than $100 million. Mm-hmm. And I think that Godzilla Minus One is just, it should be the ultimate example people look at now. Because scenes, man, those, when he uses his breath, it is wild. It's so wild.
I haven't really sat and thought about, when he uses the breath in like the parts of his tail start poking out. I mean, it's so seamless.
Sexy.
It's great. And yeah, I mean, Gareth Edwards talked about how you can save money. Like he was like, when it's a day when we're shooting like conversations, we don't need every single person who's involved with the movie to be on set. Like you don't need to be. But it's just that Disney has so much money to throw around, and it's not, I feel like so much of it isn't being done by the people working on the film. It's just like money being thrown at stuff and somehow something like gets put together, but it's not a focused, you know, ordeal.
Have you seen the news that like the director of Godzilla Minus One is interested, or he's been wanting to make a Star Wars movie?
A Star Wars movie, yep.
I feel like that fucking Breaking Bad meme where he's in the back of the car, like yelling. He's like, no, don't do it.
But he really wants to.
I know he wants to. And that, who am I to say don't do it? If he wants to do it, he should be able to do it. I just, you know, the Star Wars community can be really intense at times. And, you know, if heaven forbid he does things his way and people don't like it, and then he's just never being able to direct anything again in like the States. I just don't want him to get spent on a Star Wars movie, you know?
Right. But it's all,
or even locked into Star Wars only. Heaven forbid he does one Star Wars movie and then like signs like a fucking 10 movie contract and we never see anything but Star Wars from him.
I know, it's frightening. And so many people, like directors, get flack when the real problem is the script. I think people just don't really understand that.
Any Oscar potential there?
For Godzilla Minus One?
Yeah.
In a just world.
I don't believe Japan chose it for their... Actually, I know Japan did not chose it for their Oscar contender. They chose
did submit? Anything?
I believe they chose Perfect Days. The Wim Wenders or Vim Wenders movie?
Oh.
I'm almost positive.
And is it, if there's a film that's, you know, only maybe eligible for like best foreign film, like could this be up for special effects?
Yeah.
Or no, because it's not. Oh, okay.
I was right. Japan picks Wim Wenders' Perfect Days as their submission for the Oscars.
Okay.
So Godzilla Minus One did not get chosen. So, but it can get chosen for, yeah, visual effects. I mean, like last year, RRR did not get chosen for India's submission, but they were still able to get nominated for Best Song and ultimately won. So there is a possibility, but I think the visual effects might be the biggest hurdle for like general audiences. Because while I think it looks good, it does have a specific visual style that is very unique to Japan and the Toho style of making Godzilla. This is why I think back in 1998, they changed Godzilla. It's not a visual VFX style that I think general American audiences are used to looking at. I mean, fuck, right now people were upset the way that Furiosa looks. Like, man, the general population, they're not the smartest people, if I'm being honest.
Well, then what would win?
For best visual effects this year?
I think Oppenheimer will be in.
Who? There's a different movie. What's a big movie? Gotta not go, Dune
what
2.
Was the,
Wonka?
Like, it's not... obviously,
hey,
all the Marvel
people
movies.
Are liking Wonka right now.
Okay. You can keep it.
Are you not convinced yet?
No.
So here are the frontrunners according to...
Even if I do like Wonka, you won't be hearing that from me. Oh, the creator.
The creator is a frontrunner. Oppenheimer, Guardians of the Galaxy 3, Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse, Transformers, Rise of the Beast, The Little Mermaid, Napoleon, The Marvels, Indiana Jones, Blue Beetle are all in varieties.
Wait, how can Across the Spider-Verse, how's that work? Can animated
I don't
movies
know.
Be?
I mean, some to an extent, there? I guess. I don't really know the specifics
there
of that
one. There
must
be like VFX work in addition to the animation.
You know, at number 14, so Variety has listed these 1 through 20. You know what's at number 14?
Napoleon.
Cocaine Bear.
No.
Swear to God.
Oh my God, there it is.
Hey, Wonka's number 18. It's there.
What?
Wonka?
Because of
Ferrari.
The bear?
Yeah, no, because of Aldrin Ehrenreich. Yes, of course, because of the bear.
Wow. Ferrari, Mission Impossible, Wonka, D&D. That's my pick.
D&D is a good pick. I like that pick a lot.
Bully
I wouldn't be surprised if it was like Little Mermaid, The Creator, Oppenheimer, Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, I think Oppenheimer will win it, or The Creator.
I could see The Creator
they
taking
seem
it.
To agree.
Yeah. That'd be the one, like, most obvious pick. But Oppenheimer,
but
probably in long run.
Well, yeah, Oppenheimer has a better, like, campaign energy for that because people have been talking about how they did it. The Creator, it's so forgettable of a movie. I don't know if there's any hype for it in that regard.
John Wick Chapter 4? No? Not on here?
Dude, if they're going to add an action category for the Oscars, it's just disappointing if it doesn't happen this year because this is the imagine they add it this year. John Wick 4 wins.
John Wick 4, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, Extraction 2, Silent Night.
Yeah.
Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3.
Like
that's a fine category.
Yes.
I'm not saying that they deserve to be in there. So, Gran Turismo or what? Does that count?
Ooh. No.
At any rate, okay. I don't think Godzilla Minus One will be in contention for any Oscars. Not that exactly matters. I'm just always curious when an international film kind of has a bigger splash over here in the States. I'm always kind of curious to see how that will kind of affect award season and maybe the future of those kinds of movies. So,
right,
it'll be interesting to watch. Okay. The final thing I wrote down for us was the Rotten Tomato scores for the other Godzilla movies. 1997, the score was 20% critic, 28% audience.
Wow.
I wasn't joking. The movie was bad.
That's really
Godzilla
bad.
2014, 76%, 66% audience score.
Okay.
Pretty middling, pretty divisive. Yeah. It's a divisive movie.
Wow, the audience is, that's low.
But here's what's interesting about this movie. It's divisive because a lot of the criticism is there's not a lot of Godzilla in it. And guess what? There's not a lot of Godzilla Minus One either.
Yeah, but if your characters are bad, then it's a skill issue.
I don't think they're that bad in Godzilla in the 2014 version.
But
I think you should revisit it and let me know what you think.
Okay, I would like to. I have to finish Shin Godzilla, which I'm very much liking.
Oh, I like Shin Godzilla. It's a good one, too.
As soon as someone said it's like Godzilla Doctor Strange love, I was like, oh, I'm watching that immediately.
What, Shin Godzilla?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it's good. It's good. It's another movie where like Godzilla's in it, but you spend a lot of time in like the war room and a lot of time with these like politicians. Yeah. It's a good one. Godzilla King of the Monsters, 42% critic score, 83% audience score. In my review on Letterboxd, I said that it's a shame that American adaptations and Hollywood adaptations have like more focus on just like big monster punches things, but it's more said that it feels like it's working. And this is the prime example of that. Some people just like don't care. They just want to see Godzilla fight shit.
I know. And sometimes like that's how I'm excited. I think it's still in our plan for some day to talk about Pacific Rim.
Yes, at some point.
I'd really love to watch Pacific Rim because I watched it when it came out when I was younger, and it very much was like, I loved it. I love seeing giant monsters fighting giant robots, but I'm like, I wonder if I revisit if I feel like there is a good story there.
I think that movie is a nice combination of two kind of worlds, or how do I say this? I think the movie is doing a decent balancing act of the big kaijus fighting these big ass robots, but also giving us a really interesting like relationship exploration of the two people. I mean, inherently the robots in that movie, you have to have like a connection with them, which I think is interesting.
True.
So
yeah,
it kind
actually,
of lends itself to having a nice emotional core.
Being very drawn to that concept.
Yeah. But yeah, Godzilla King of the Monsters is a movie that I think is pretty sloppy, pretty middling. But like, yeah, there's a scene where like fucking Godzilla fights Ghidorah, and there's scenes with fucking Mothra. And that alone will get people excited sometimes. Yeah. And so that's why they keep making these movies. So yeah,
people do like the MonsterVerse.
They do like the MonsterVerse. Godzilla versus Kong, 76% critic score, 91% audience score. People like the big monkey and him fighting the big lizard, you know. So we'll see. Are you excited for Godzilla versus Kong 2 or Godzilla and Kong? I forgot what it's called.
I don't know if I'm like a MonsterVerse person.
Wow.
Are you like into it? You seem like you're into it.
I'm only into it to the extent that, like, I will always just be into Godzilla. I love Godzilla. Godzilla's just a really cool character. The lore is rich. I just kind of eat it up regardless.
You like him more than King Kong?
Oh, yeah. Fuck yeah. Are there King Kong truthers out there?
Yes, there are. Honestly, wow. More than you might expect.
What?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I thought Skull Island was fine. I didn't, like, hate it, but I don't love it.
And King Kong's, that's like an American thing. Like, we should stick to that.
Yeah. I think the Peter Jackson King Kong, low-key, very underrated.
I think it's having a reclamation, as it should.
Is it time?
I think it's time, dude.
Oh, hell yeah.
I'll never forget seeing that movie for the first time.
It is 3 hours, but, like, Peter Jackson knew what he was doing. It made me cry when I saw it, when I was,
really?
Like, in my 20s. I think the ending is really sad.
Yeah, it really makes you feel for the big guy.
That's one way to put it,
but
sure.
I
feel for the big guy, I do. Okay.
Yeah,
all
I
right.
want to rewatch that now, wow.
Like maybe one day if we get 3 extra hours, we can watch it and talk about
Monster Month?
Monster Month?
What?
It's not a bad idea. Not a bad idea. All right, well, we've reached the end. Our final score for Godzilla Minus One, would you give it?
4.5 out of 5.
Where's it rank on your top 10 this year?
Dude, I think I put it at like 6.
Whoa. That's
what
pretty
about
fucking...
you? I'm a blockbuster. Every time I come to my year-end ranking, I'm like, I like blockbusters a lot. when they're good, dude, it's just so much fun.
You're right. You're right. I agree with you. I have it at number 11 right now, but... honestly, the more we talked about it, the more we've been like breaking it down. I want to see it again really badly.
Me too.
I could see it easily breaking top 10, if I'm being honest.
They just nailed it.
They did. they did. And you want to say anything about May December before we close out? I mean, we don't have a lot of time left, but do you want to say anything about May December?
May December. I mean, it's.
I phrased definitely... that as if it was a bad movie, but it's not at all. That's my fault.
No, it's a great movie.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are talking about it on Twitter right now because it just dropped on Netflix on Friday. I mean, I would just really love to encourage everyone to check it out. I've been looking into the real life case that it's based on a lot. I mean, it's like, I don't want to say it's loosely based. Like, Todd Haynes obviously took creative liberties with the story, but it's just a really interesting look at like true crime and how we kind of sensationalize these things. And Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore are so good in it. Have you, I know that you were kind of like, whoa, it's a tough one to nail down. And I agreed. Have you had your thoughts change on it at all since you saw it?
Yeah, I not in a negative way though, in a more positive way. I took some time to kind of read other people's reactions and reviews on it, kind of gauge how they interacted with it and how they felt about it. I've watched the first half on Netflix this morning. And late last night when I was home. It's a good movie, man. It is
really
unsettling at times. And I think we've made it pretty clear, or I've made it pretty clear. I think everybody made it pretty clear. Natalie Portman and Julianne Moore are very good. Charles Melton is somehow even better, in my opinion. I really do think, like, I know Robert Downey Jr. right now must be sweating bullets for his Oscar.
Dude, Robert Downey Jr. shouldn't get it.
Did we say that on the public side podcast or the Patreon side?
I think it might have been the Patreon because, oh, no, but why would we be talking about, maybe it was on May the December. News? I don't remember.
No, what did we talk about last Tuesday? Oh, we did November recap. Yeah, we had seen May December at that point.
Oh.
So we did mention it. So we're kind of repeating ourselves in the second week in a row.
No, but I don't think, yeah, we mentioned it, but it wasn't, I don't think we were considering it a November film.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why I didn't say Charles Melton when I mentioned the two female leads. He is probably, because he has maybe the most challenging role to play. And I don't know how much we want to say about, so I went into this movie very blind. I'd seen like good reactions out of Cannes, but I didn't really, all I knew was like Natalie Portman is playing an actress who is studying Julianne Moore's like complicated relationship because she's going to play her in a movie. I didn't know what kind of relationship it was and why it was complicated. And I actually wish that I had before I
saw
the movie. Yeah, I do, because I think, I mean, the screenplay is so good. It's one of those screenplays where it feels like every single line of dialogue is like interacting with one another. And I kind of wish I'd had that context from the get-go so that I can think more carefully about like what exactly was going on.
I think that's why I'm enjoying it more the second time, because I now know its subject matter. It does feel like every line serves a purpose and they're all kind of coexisting together in this like really unsettling and tragic harmony.
Yeah.
And it's making the second watch a lot more interesting. A lot more engaging, I think.
I agree. Yeah, I put it back on this morning, too. There are some lines in this movie, dude, that are horrific, like horrifying.
Yeah.
Just like what they are evoking, just in really simple things that people are saying. You're like, oh,
yeah,
my God,
the delivery is so like nonchalant. But like the sentence itself, like if you pull it and just stare at that sentence, it is a horrifying statement to say.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is
that's,
really...
But that's, oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's another film that's kind of challenging our perception of things and kind of challenging us to look at how we view these like tabloid events and all of this where it's like this is their life. It's honestly a bit mundane. And I think there's some horror in that because we think of these terrible things that people do and it's like they're not these people who are like rampaging around society. Oftentimes they're people who have been victims as well and are so traumatized that they're almost in denial about their own behaviors. And then also just like, you know, why are we so seduced by these like true crime stories. I think Todd Haynes is really wanting us to ask ourselves that.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpack with May December, which I feel so bad trying to like squeeze it in the last 10 minutes. Yeah. As podcasters, we're not going to do it justice because it's a movie I feel like will take multiple watches. It's a movie that I feel like deserves to be unpacked. Mm-hmm. Because there's so much going on from like the moment it starts to the moment it ends. So many scenes between characters, so many interactions that deserve a little bit more exploration, which we don't really have time for that right now. But I think the point is that we want to get across is that it's really good.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. I'm liking a lot more in the second watch. Charles Melton, I hope I at this point, you know, I haven't seen Poor Things. I'm seeing it tomorrow. I do think he deserves the Oscar currently. We'll see how the rest of the year plays out and the other movies coming out. But I do think if I'm campaigning for anybody, it's going to be him right now.
I think he deserves it also above Mark Ruffalo. Though Mark Ruffalo, it's like a really fun comedic turn for him.
Uh-huh.
But Charles Melton he's really digging into something really.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, it's the hardest character to play. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's playing an adult, like a young boy trapped in an adult's body. And it's
exactly.
Really hard to convey that kind of message. But
exactly.
He nails it from like the body language to his mannerisms, just everything.
It's heartbreaking.
It's so heartbreaking. Yeah. Just thinking about it right now, it makes me so sad.
It is. Yeah, it's sad.
Wow. Okay. May December. Go watch it. That
yeah,
is officially
definitely check it out. Yeah.
It's right.
It's crazy that a film like that of that caliber is just sitting on Netflix. Like, there's no reason not to check it out. I do hope the screenplay gets nominated. I mean, I think it will.
It's going to have a tough competition, though. It will have to face off against the Holdovers.
Why?
Isn't May December an original?
Yeah, but why not both?
I think
you mean in terms
original.
Of winning?
In terms of winning.
Man, do I think... I think... I know. It's a tie. Let's break up the crown and throw out the pieces.
You get the bottom half of the statue, you get the top half.
Yeah, I mean, the Holdovers is also so... I mean, they're so different. I wouldn't
so
be mad
different.
about either of them winning.
I know. Yeah, we'll talk more Oscar talk in January, probably. Mm-hmm. But for now... Yeah. Go watch May December. It's on Netflix. Go watch Godzilla Minus One. It's out in theaters now. Silent Night's in theaters. You can decide if you want to do that one.
If you're a Wu fan, check it out. Let me know what you thought. I do wish,
yeah,
I know the public episodes, I'm like, man, I wish there was a comment section. But like, message us.
True.
Tweet us on
Respond
Twitter
to our
or
stories.
Something.
Tweet out. Yeah, tweet your response on Twitter.
Letterboxd comments.
You could also follow the Patreon for free. You don't have to.
Yes,
you can sign up
that
and follow
too.
For free. Yeah, tweet at us. And speaking of tweeting at us and Instagram stories, we want to thank everybody who tagged us in all the Spotify Wrapped.
Yeah.
It was an emotional day, an overwhelming day of emotions to see how many people were tagging us in their like most listened to podcasts of the year or top five. It was just a lot. And we just want to express our deepest thanks
for
that.
Yeah, thank you guys. It was crazy to me that I kept seeing them really like, say like thank you for being my top podcast. I'm like, thank you, dude. You're the one who's listening.
I know. It's
so yeah, thank you guys. And even if you know you're listening to other podcasts as well, and we weren't in your top. Thanks for listening, anyways. That was so crazy.
Podcasts is a crazy big world. So the fact that you choose to listen to us once or 100 times, we appreciate you just tuning in at least the one time or the 100 times.
Yeah.
Perfect. Awesome. All right. Well, next week, Poor Things finally. I think so. I think it's time.
Wow. Yeah.
Next week, Poor Things.
I'm excited for you to see it.
I'm very pumped. I'll ask. It's followed by a Willem Dafoe Q&A. I'll talk to him maybe.
Ugh.
I won't. But,
I know. Joe all the time. I mean, the argument for me to move to LA just gets stronger by the minute. It's 30 degrees
so I will
here.
Ooh. Next week, Poor Things, and then we'll keep you guys updated. But thank you so much for listening. Sydney, I'll talk to you later. Everybody else, have a wonderful day, night, weekend, and we'll see you guys next week.
Goodbye, listeners.